Hello, welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She's the USU Extension Entomologist, and if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and add your comment there. So I hope you'll stay with us for the program. We've got a lot of great things to talk about. And Diane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
All right. So I've been talking to you over the week because it seems like I come up with the questions when I have them in my own yard. So I've noticed over the summer that I have a lilac that's got some branches that are dying out. And this is a lilac that's not too old. It's about 10, 12 years old. It's up against the north side of my house, so it doesn't get a lot of light, but it gets enough light that it produces blossoms every year. But I noticed that the center of it toward the top was starting to die back. And I finally went out and looked. I saw the insect frass, and I got looking a little closer, and I cut out one of the branches that had died, and you can see tunnels going hither and yon, and I knew I had some kind of borer that was in there. And you sent me some information, and it's the insect I have not seen, but where the insect has pupated, they've left their
little skins
mm-hmm. sticking outside of the trunk, and it's exactly what this is. It's the lilac ash borer.
That's right. That's
how do you
what
say
it
borer?
Is. That's a hard word to say. Boring borer. But yes, it's an insect that is common here in Utah, across the whole state. It has, as the name suggests, it has two primary hosts, lilac and ash. So it's kind of interesting, you know, that goes. It can go to either of those. We see it as a problem in both, and it is a clearwing moth. So kind of an interesting insect. The moths actually look more like a wasp than they do like a typical moth.
I was going to say, the picture, you would not think it's a moth, mm-mm. other than looking at the antenna, mm-hmm. which does look like a moth and not belonging to like a yellow jacket or
right.
something.
And they also have a thicker body, so they don't have that skinny waist like many of the wasps do. But it is a day-flying moth, and so because it's a clearwing moth, that group of moths, they fly during the daytime. So again, kind of unusual. Most moths are active at night. But this insect does lay its eggs on lilac and ash, and the larvae tunnel into the wood, just as you said, and you see these tunnels kind of throughout the whole limb. It goes into the heartwood as well as, you know, bores through the cambial layer. And that makes them a particularly difficult insect to control in that systemic types of materials don't tend to work very well on them because they're into this inner wood area where they're not going to be accessing any of the insecticide that's in the tree. You can get
the insecticide's coming up in the outer layer, if
right,
you will.
In that vascular tissue. And, you know, there can be some low levels of mortality if a larva happens to chew right into that at the time when the insecticide is there. But in general, systemics aren't known to be very effective for these clear wing moth types of pests. And so the primary way to manage them, unfortunately, well, first let's talk about you want to do things that keep the tree or in this case, the lilac bush as healthy as possible. That's the first step. And then the second main step would be using insecticides. But let's talk about that first. So my main suggestion to you was to do some renewal pruning. So prune out, especially with lilac, that's a fairly, you know, vigorous kind of plant in general here in our environment. You can cut out those older stems, the ones that have the borers in them, and get some, you know, new growth coming on. Make sure you're fertilizing, putting some fertilizer down, irrigating properly, anything that you can do to kind of, you know, just enhance the growth.
And you mean I have to do work?
You have to keep the shrub as healthy as possible. Now, ash trees, of course, pruning out the stem is not really an option unless you're cutting down pretty much the entire tree. Sometimes you might have them in some of the limbs, and you can certainly prune those out. But if it's down into the main trunk of the limb of the tree, then that's not so much an option. So the other main way, unfortunately, are preventive insecticide sprays. And we have a fact sheet on the USU Extension website called the Lilac Ash Borer. And in there, there's a nice little table that shows you, based on temperature, when you can expect the adult moths to be active for different parts of the state. And so in the southern part of Utah, we're talking more in April. And as we get up along the Wasatch Front, they start emerging in the spring in May. And as you get up here into Cache Valley, Rich County, some of our colder parts of the state, it's not going to be until early June or thereabouts that the adults are first coming out. And so that would be the time to put on a preventive or protective trunk spray. And this would apply to both ash or lilac if you've had this problem in the past.
So any kind of ash.
Yes, I think pretty much the most of them are very susceptible to this insect.
Podocicia syringae?
Yep.
Did I pronounce it right?
Yeah,
wow.
Good job.
Okay,
good
great.
Job.
I love these Latin names, but there's a great picture right on the front. So you can, I don't know if anybody's going to be able to tell a difference. If you see this flying around, you're automatically going to think, that looks like a hornet.
Right. You're not going to often recognize, unless you
or
see
a yellow
them
jacket.
Moving, yeah. Actually emerging from their pupil case, then you might, you know, get to see the moth right at that moment.
Okay, so let me ask this. I know with conifers, we've talked about how that when they get stressed, they this scent
different kinds of alpha pinenes and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, get sent out, and right. that attracts the Ips beetle to the tree.
Right.
Does the lilac or the ash do the same thing?
And yeah, I don't know exactly what the compound is that it releases, but yes, in general, it's trees that are already stressed have some decline. Certainly trees that have been previously attacked also. I'm sure that the insects are able to pick up. There is a pheromone, and so there is you can monitor with a sex pheromone. And so we do, the IPM program here does run some of those traps, and we let you know when we catch the first lilac ash borers of the year in different parts of the state. And that's timed with that those timings that I was just mentioning. That's in the table there in the fact sheet.
So are these native?
And, as far as I know,
I would imagine
they
yes, because yeah. ashes have been around. Lilacs aren't native, but
right. As far as I know, they are. I'd have to read the introduction section that fact sheet to remind myself: are they native to North America, or did they come in from somewhere else? But it's a very common insect. It's been one of the main reasons that ash trees have, sometimes we get calls, you know, a bunch of ash were planted into a new housing development area or a new commercial development area, and they all seem to have these borers, and it's like, oh, you know, you set yourself up for a regular schedule of applying, you know, insecticides to those trees to keep them from going down, at least until they can get established and large enough and healthy enough that you wouldn't have to do that, at least not every year.
So the borer that were in my lilacs, they've left. There's nothing in the tree.
No, they overwinter as larvae inside.
The,
right. So they're in the stems or the trunks of the
so
tree.
So if I want to prune it out, do I just keep pruning down until I see no more tunneling?
Yes, you could do that. Generally with lilac, I just kind of take the whole, you know, much of the main stem or the, you know, that if it's a side stem.
Because you want to do the renewal pruning.
Right, because okay. I want to get some new growth to come on. That's usually how I'm pruning lilacs. And they're common in lilacs, but usually I don't know that insecticides are used that often in lilac. It's more of just trying to keep, you know, the renewal pruning, keep the shrub healthy. And generally those kinds of techniques are effective enough. Ash trees, it's a little harder, and that's where insecticides often are necessary.
So where's the moth going once it pupates?
So they're emerging starting in this April, May, June time period. And so they're coming out. Males and females are looking for each other. The female releases a sex pheromone that draws the male to her. And that's how we can use a pheromone trap to help monitor when they're out. They mate. The females will then go in search of susceptible trees or you know, stems of lilac and ash to lay their eggs on, and then, you know, and they're around for a month or so, but it's pretty much just a single generation, and
so the adults are probably dead by now.
Oh yes, there's no adults left now.
This
happened over the summer.
So if I have this lilac with issues, and I have five or six other lilacs within 30 to 40 feet of where this one was, are the others likely to be infected?
Well,
although I don't see any damage.
Right.
At this point.
And so my guess is that they're probably a little happier. That is, they're not as stressed. Maybe there, you know, there could be some varietal difference in susceptibility or attractiveness as well. So again, with the lilacs, I'm not a big advocate of spraying them. If you have some, you know, if this is a lilac that, you know, you obviously you selected this variety because you were very attracted to it. You might want to consider, you know, first doing the renewal pruning and then spraying this individual. I wouldn't necessarily spray all of your lilacs unless you start to see some problems. Lilacs are generally pretty hardy. You know, you can, they're not, you're not going to lose the shrub in a year. Ash are a little different story. Again, we've had some situations where there's a lot of ash in a particular area and they've, you know, many of them have been attacked. And really the only way in that case to get over the problem is to use some insecticide sprays.
Does the tree have any kind of defense mechanism? If you're a conifer and you're growing pretty well, you push sap into
right.
the holes.
And deciduous trees do that too. And it varies, you know, how effective they are. Again, a stressed or lower health tree is not going to be able to produce, not going to have those sap resources to be able to put into those holes to push out the insect. The other thing about this type of borer is that once it's in, it does move into that inner wood. And the trees don't really have any defense once they're in there. It'd have to happen right at that bark cambial layer, not once it's inside.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's Extension Entomologist. She's my guest for the hour. And if you have any questions or comments, we would welcome your questions at 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. The address is zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there as well. Just kind of, so moving on, I'm thinking, all right, so right now with this tree, there's not a whole lot I can do with it now other than just prune out the middle and hope for the best.
Well, I have another question for you. There's another insect that likes lilacs called the lilac root weevil. Now, this is related to the strawberry root weevil, and they both, the adults cause notching on the edges of the leaves, and there's different kinds of notching, but the kind that these root weevils cause is more of a regular kind of pattern. It's not nice, smooth, round. The nice, smooth, round leaf pieces can be maybe from a leaf cutter bee, and that's different. And they're not usually causing that much harm. They're just kind of collecting leaf pieces here and there. But the root weevils are a pest because they also feed on the roots. Now, the lilac root weevil loves lilacs, as the name suggests. And so I'm going to ask you, do you think you have the lilac root weevil on this particular lilac that's having the problem with the borer as well?
No, because I've not seen any notching on it. I have seen some notching on the other ones, mm-hmm. but I've not been worried about it. I've not seen anything dying back or so forth. Will this same root weevil go to other hosts like?
Yes, it likes privet. I see it commonly on a wide range of different kinds of shrubs, in particular. Also, I see it on.
What about peonies?
Peonies. That's what I was trying to say. Peonies at the same time.
That's the one I asked about.
It also likes peonies, yes.
I go out at night and have looked at the peony because mm-hmm. I've seen the notching, and you just see the black, these root weevils all over it.
Right.
And you just barely touch it, and they just drop right off.
And that's the time to see the adults is go out at night with your flashlight if you suspect that might be causing notches on leaves of a plant, and then
so,
you can see them at nighttime.
I keep saying so. I've got to stop myself from doing that. So there we go again. So, down in the plant itself with a peony, are they also feeding on the roots of
yes,
the peony?
Yes, the larvae are. And so what I was going to say in terms of the lilac situation any of these plants that they attack is that can be an additional stress. And so if the lilac is being fed on by root weevil, and root weevils on lilacs are very common. I mean, almost every lilac I see, I see some notching, some level of notching. So it's not uncommon, and lilacs tend to do just fine despite having that. But if it's the populations build up and it's becoming a real stress on the plant, then that could be a contributing factor to making this lilac more attractive to the lilac root, lilac ash borer as well.
Then I can take the drench that I was going to put on the lilac and maybe put it on the peony to see what that
yes.
does.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, the peony, usually peonies, you need to have them in full sun, and it was planted before we moved in, and it's getting a lot of shade. It still blooms, but it probably doesn't get as big or as vigorous growing
right.
as it would normally.
And
so.
A lot of times, again, with lilacs, with peonies and other kinds of shrubs that these root weevils feed on, the plant can kind of almost just outgrow it. And, you know, I mean, yes, there's some there taking a little bit of nutrition away by feeding on the roots, but the plant is still able to compensate just fine. Where the one of its relatives called the strawberry root weevil, so very closely related, different species of root weevil. Sometimes in strawberry patches, if you have an older patch that, you know, you've had for a while, numbers can build up fairly high there, and you can see a real decrease in yield of your strawberries.
Well, and the suggestion there is strawberry plants are so inexpensive,
mm-hmm.
just change them out every 3 or 4 years.
Right, and usually if you are keeping an area that has strawberries in it, but if you do some renewal there, that is come through and cultivate through and take out some of the old plants, so you get some of those daughter plants, you know, started and kind of keep that going. I mean, you still have root weevils there, but at least you got new vigorous plants and you don't tend to see that yield suppression like you do with the older plants.
If you were going to take them out, would you do it in the fall so that there's a full winter without new plants being in there? Would that depress the populations of the root weevil?
I think you could cultivate either fall or spring. It's true that cultivating the fall might help reduce the root weevil populations more effectively.
Okay. Yeah. I have a question that I was in my dad's garden, and he said, "What happened to my beans?" And I turned around and looked, and they were all dead. I was going to guess some kind of mite, because it looks like they've just withered away and died, and he watered really quite well. But that it has that mottled look on the leaf, like I've seen on some grapes, for instance.
Okay.
And as well, it was a really hot summer, Dad, and I didn't see anything on them now because they were crispy and dried up. I've never seen beans go quite like that.
Okay.
But if he had a high enough mite population.
Yes, beans are very attractive to spider mites. But let me describe that there's some subtle differences in the way they feed and what the symptoms look like. So spider mites are very tiny, like the, you know, pinhead size. And so when they feed, they're actually more closely related to spiders, and they have a mouth part. We call them chelicerae, and they kind of basically stab these little suction pipes in and suck out some of the nutrients out of the leaf, taking the chlorophyll with them. And so the type of feeding is this very fine stippling or speckling of the leaves. And when there's a lot of it, it can actually cause the leaf to almost look kind of a little bronzed effect,
mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
somebody's, you know, almost brushed it with what do you call those paints that you can kind of brush on or, you know, spray on and make a very fine kind of color change. That's what spider mite injury looks like. There's insects that also feed in a similar way, but they're a little larger. Their mouth parts are a little larger. So like leafhoppers. So on grapes, a common pest is a leafhopper pest. And they also cause a stippling, but it's a little bit bigger spots. And so they're yellow,
and
white,
bronzy.
And not that bronze effect.
Okay.
And then if you look on the underside of the leaves with the leaf hoppers, generally you can also see some little black spots, which is their feces, their poop, where they've been, you know, sitting there feeding, and then they make a little black tar spot. And so that's a common association with leaf hoppers. Also, thrips are another insect that can cause some stippling, taking out that green chlorophyll color. And they also will cause a little black tar spots from their excrement as well. You don't see that with spider mites. Spider mites, you can sometimes see webbing too. So all of those are all possibilities. And then there are yet some other possibilities. If you see some other kind of mottling where you get like color, like yellow stripes or streaks or yellow spots, sometimes that can be caused by a disease such as a virus. Or sometimes even bacteria, but more commonly viruses.
And I've seen a virus get into my beans. Not all of them. It'll just be in certain mm-hmm. sections, and it kind of crinkles the leaf a little bit.
Sometimes
it's this rippling look.
Right. So kind of some strange symptoms. And
yeah.
So those are yet another possibility. And then I'll mention another one that popped to mind when you first described wilting symptoms. Surprisingly, this summer, given that we were so hot and dry, but maybe it was the heat, we've had a bit of higher level problems with some of the soil fungi, such as Fusarium or Verticillium. And they're in the soil, and they're kind of here all over all the time, but just certain conditions can make them, invade the plant and having a conducive host there. And so we've been seeing a lot more of root wilts associated with Fusarium and Verticillium this summer. And the way you can tell with those is not so – well, they wilt, but then if you cut – take a pocket knife and cut into the stem, if you see a brown layer there in the, where the vascular tissue is, that would be an indication that a fungus had been there and caused that problem. So I'm not certain what killed your father's beans.
Well, what you're describing to me, I think the wilting is – that's just a word I use. I think they just look wilted because they were dead.
Okay,
so,
right.
Because there was a bronzy cast to the leaf, so I think he did have spider mites.
And the hot, dry summer, especially later summer that we had, was very conducive conditions for spider mites.
I didn't ask him if he sprayed at all, because that can other also be, because I've told him, you know, it's one thing to spray for insects, but if you spray, you reduce beneficial insects as well, depending on what you're using. And then the spider mites come roaring back with a vengeance.
And they do. And so I don't, for spider mites, for the homeowner in particular, I rarely would recommend an actual insecticide or what we might call a miticide for that, those chemicals that are effective on mites. But there's some things you can do. But, you know, after the plant's dead, of course, it's too late. I'm sorry. But as you start to notice some of this happening, and at first it's not as obvious, obviously, so you have to be looking. And a good technique to use is just take a white sheet of paper or your hat or anything that's light in color, shake some leaves over it, and you'll see these little spots drop. A lot of times the leaves look kind of dusty because the dust does stick. And then if they move around, and you can even take your thumb and kind of smear a few, and if you get this kind of green to black color when you smear them, it's going to be spider mites. If you have a hand lens or a magnifying lens, you can look at them and you should see little tiny mites crawling around. So when you first start to notice the problem, just taking putting a nozzle, spray nozzle on your hose and washing down the plants as vigorously as they can take without blowing, you know, leaves off and so forth.
So would you take one of those nozzles and do it more of a wide spray?
Or I do it as vigorous of a spray as the plant can tolerate.
Oh, okay.
Because you want to hit the plant hard. You want both a physical impact of the water to knock the mites off. Also, the mites do not like a moist environment. They like a hot, dry environment. And so you'll wash off some of the mites. You won't get them all. You come back and you do that again 2-3 days later. And then you might need to come back again and do that another 2-3 days later. And, you know, if you do that enough, you should see the populations really plummet. And that's a very inexpensive, you know, fairly straight.
Because they can't climb back onto the plant.
Yeah, and you just, a lot of times you're killing them in the process. They're soft-bodied little tiny mites, and they're not going to survive a high-impact water spray. You won't get rid of all of them, but if you can really kind of knock them back, and you might, you know, see them come back again another few weeks later, and you might have to go through that process again. So that's the cheapest way to go. Other things you can use are horticultural mineral oil and insecticidal soap. And both of those products are effective on mites. They can kill the predatory mites, but generally predatory mites are much more active and moving around. A lot of times they can escape those physical kinds of remedies.
Are they larger?
And they're larger. Okay. And they can hide. They can kind of just right under the vein on the part of the leaf, they can kind of just stick their body up in there and to a tight spot and hide. But if you use an actual insecticide type of chemical, then you're going to eliminate the predatory mites as well.
So if the mites don't fly, where are they coming from?
So they mostly crawl. However, they do have this behavior. They are related to spiders. Remember I said, have you seen spiders balloon before? Mites can
okay.
do. People, generally when I say it, they remember, oh, I remember Charlotte's Web. Yes, the spider ballooned in that. So what they do is they put down a little piece of their webbing material, their silk, attach it to, you know, one end of something, and then they catch a wind current and they blow up on that wind current and can kind of like parachute, so to speak, up onto a plant. So mites do that as well.
Do they overwinter here, or are they coming up from the south?
No, they overwinter as adults, and they get down into leaf litter, plant debris, any kind of protected site under cracks and crevices on trunks of trees and shrubs. And they spend the winter in a what we call diapause, which is a dormancy, hibernation kind of state. Very low metabolism. They're not eating. And then they survive the winter that way.
So another reason to take care of your garden and have, I don't know if you till or exactly what, but keep things cleaned up.
Right. And then if you do, what your father should do now with those beans, although if it's been dead for a while, the mites may have already all moved off. But if you do decide that I can't rescue this, take those out right away. Either put them into a green waste bin that's going to be taken away, or if you have a very active compost pile and you can, you know, chop them up and mix them into that and you know, break down the material that way. Don't just leave them sit, because there's a lot of spider mite eggs on those plants, and they're going to be hatching and then looking for something else to. And so some of the common plants that we see problems with mites on, there's many, but beans are certainly one of those. Also, eggplant in the garden is another one that they particularly like. And then lots of different ornamentals are quite susceptible. So,
well, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with the rest of the hour with Diane Alston. We want your questions, so please call 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email question. The address is zestygarden@gmail.com, or post a comment to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Coming up right now, we're going to have the next Petals and Prose segment. A former English teacher here at Utah State University is going to be doing this. It is on Vita Sackville West. And Helen Cannon is the person who's reading about Vita Sackville West. So I hope you enjoy this.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I wanted today to explain a little bit how I go about choosing what I read and what I talk about. And my tacit assumption is not fully justified, because I assume a continuity of listenership, and so I have a certain connectedness in the pieces that I read and in what I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is talk about writers who are gardeners, or gardeners who are also writers. The writers I have talked about: Catherine White of The New Yorker, who lived in the East, Jamaica Kincaid from Antigua, who resented the colonial imposition of plants on that colony, and who writes spunky and outspoken screeds about imposed gardens. She detested having to learn Wordsworth's poem about daffodils, and she detested daffodils themselves because they weren't natural or native to Antigua. I'm moving now to a couple of famous garden writers whose works have no application to us, or little application to us here in the West. They were aristocrats. They had manors and huge gardens that are visited still. Vita Sackville West was an aristocrat, and Jamaica Kincaid wrote about her at one point, saying how she liked her gardens, or she was interested in her gardens, but she resented her wealth and her position. Vita was also a good friend of Virginia Woolf. Their correspondence has been published in book form. Jamaica Kincaid, in an essay on Monet's garden, says, "A garden will die with its owner. A garden will die with the death of the person who made it. I had this realization one day while walking around the great, even worthwhile effort that is Sissinghurst." Now, Sissinghurst is Vita Sackville West's garden, and her husband, Harold Nicholson. Sissinghurst is extraordinary. It has all the impersonal beauty of a park, yet part of it has the intimacy of a garden you could imagine creating yourself, if only you were capable. And then again, to see how a garden will die with a gardener, you have only to look at Monet's friend, Giverny, die, in which I was standing one day early in June. It means so much to me and other people traipsing around. What would it mean to us without the paintings? And so she goes on to say that the paintings are really the things that preserve Monet's garden, not the garden itself that they attempt to grow as Monet had it, but rather his paintings of his gardens. Vida's passion for plants was shaped by her love of old Dutch flower paintings and by the choice species she saw in her travels, sometimes with Harold, to places such as Persia and the Alps. I'd like to give you a couple of her essays to get a feeling for the delight of her writing. This is her essay on zinnias. Anthologists sometimes take a special delight in quoting botanical howlers made by reputable authors, but unless I've overlooked it, which is quite likely, no anthologist has yet put a finger on Walter Pater's howler on Marius the Epicurean. He makes his Romans go in search of zinnias wherewith to deck themselves. Quote, they visited the flower market lingering where the coronae pressed on them the newest species, and they purchased zinnias, now in blossom, to decorate the folds of their togas. Now, either Pater had some botanical information drawn from Roman historians and subsequently mislaid by us, or else he was merely drawing on his imagination to find a flower which he thought was suitable to decorate a toga. If he was just drawing on his imagination, he went absurdly wrong, for as the zinnia is a native of America and Mexico, and Marius lived in Rome in the 2nd century A.D., Pater is out by only 12 centuries. He was, in fact, enriching Rome by a flower from a continent not due for discovering until some 1,200 years later. I suppose it must be granted under the heading poetic license. In actual fact, the original zinnia, or zinnia elegans, was introduced into European countries in 1796 and since then has been, quote, improved into the garden varieties we now know and grow. Many flowers lose by this so-called improvement. The zinnia has gained. Some people call it artificial looking, and so in a way it is. It looks as though it had been cut out of bits of cardboard, ingeniously glued together into the semblance of a flower. It is prim and stiff and arranged and precise, almost geometrically precise, so that many people who prefer the more romantic, lavish flowers reject it, just on account of its stiffness and regularity. Besides, they say, and rightly, it gives a lot of trouble to grow. It is only half-hardy in this country, and thus has to be sown in a seed box under glass in February or March, pricked out, and then planted in May, where we want it to flower. We have to be very careful not to water the seedlings too much or they will damp off and die. And then, when we have planted it out, we have to be on the lookout for slugs which have it in for zinnias, an affection greatly exceeding our own. Why should we take all this trouble about growing a flower which we know is going to be cut down by the first autumn frost? Such arguments crash like truncheons, and it takes an effort to renew our determination by recalling the vivid bed which gave us weeks of pleasure last year. For there are few flowers more brilliant without being crude, and since they are sun lovers, the hot, dry spot where we plant them will shower the maximum of light on the formal heads and array of colors. Whether we grow them in a mixture, sold, I regret to say, under the description of art shades, or separate, the pink from the orange, the red from the magenta, is a matter of taste. Personally, I like the higgledy-piggledy, when they look like those pats of paint squeezed out upon the palette, and I like them all by themselves, not associated with anything else. As cut flowers, they are invaluable. They never flop, and they last, I was going to say, for weeks. A friend of mine brought me a beautiful bouquet of zinnias, and I love contemplating that bouquet, even though it's gone now, as I read Vida's essay. She, in her Sissinghurst garden, made one famous garden, which was her white garden. She says of writing about gardens, it's very difficult to write about flowers. Think, if we all come down to details, how difficult it is in ordinary language. So simple a fact is that a flower smells good. There is no other possible term in English by which we may describe the attribute. If we say it smells, we automatically imply that it smells bad. So instead of the honest word smell, we are forced to the genteel substitution of scent or perfume, neither of which conveys in the least what we mean to say when we say a flower smells good. Smells good is an honest phrase, at least, and neither scent nor perfume nor odor nor fragrance can take its place. They must be relegated to the special dictionary of writers on flowers and gardens, in which quaint and dainty and winsome must also take dishonorable rank. Color offers another trap. Not only is color almost impossible to render vividly in words, but unless you go on repeating the word over and over again, you are reduced to such evasions as hue and colorful. The latter Americanism, which I refuse to adopt, hue, I think, is just permissible when very specially and nicely applied. Otherwise, it's inexcusable. So, turning to her white garden, the birth of the white garden, it is amusing to make one-color gardens. They need not necessarily be large, and they need not necessarily be enclosed, though the enclosure of a dark hedge is, of course, ideal. Failing this, any secluded corner will do, even a strip of border running under a wall, perhaps the wall of the house. For my part, I am trying to make a gray and white garden. This is an experiment which I ardently hope may be successful, though I doubt it. One's best ideas seldom play up in practice to one's expectations, especially in gardening where everything looks so well on paper and in catalogs, but fails so lamentably in fulfillment after you've tucked your plants into the soil. Still, one hopes. My gray and white garden will have the advantage of a high yew hedge behind it, a wall along one side. It is, in fact, nothing more than a fairly large bed, which has now been divided into halves by a short path of gray flagstones terminating in a rough wooden seat. Where you sit on the seat, you will be turning your back to the yew hedge. From there, I hope you will survey a low sea of gray clumps of foliage, pierced here and there with tall white flowers. I visualize the white trumpets of dozens of regal lilies, grown 3 years ago from seed coming up through the gray of southern wood and artemisia, and cotton lavender with gray and white edging, plants such as dianthus and the silvery mats of Stachys lantana, or more familiar under English names of rabbit's ears or savior's flannel. There will be white pansies and white peonies and white irises with their gray leaves. At least I hope there will be these things. I don't want to boast in advance about my gray and white garden. It may be a terrible failure. I wanted only to suggest that such experiments are worth trying and that you can adapt them to your own taste and your own opportunities. All the same, I cannot help hoping that the great ghostly barn owl will sweep silently across a pale garden next summer in the twilight, the pale garden that I am now planting under the first flakes of snow. And apparently at Sissinghurst, which was a castle that they restored, she and her husband had their dinner in one part of the castle. Then they walked through the white garden to their bedroom, and that white garden in the moonlight was exceedingly beautiful. Over 100,000 people visit Sissinghurst in England every year, and they look forward to that white garden. Vita was not the first, however, to try a white garden. It was tried earlier by a garden writer named Gertrude Jekyll. And next time, I will talk a little bit about Gertrude Jekyll and her philosophy and her white garden. So this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose and some thoughts about garden writers.
Make it beautiful and edible. Fall garden containers, that is. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Bright Light, Ruby Red, and many other Swiss chard cultivars have colorful stems to brighten any fall combination. Kale and collard greens also provide vertical interest in containers. Wild Garden Frills Russian Kale has blue-green frilled leaves, while a cinnato has crinkled foliage. Colorful leaf lettuce, mustard, and other greens make great fillers. Radina and Sea of Red are just two of the many colorful leaf lettuce cultivars. Try Garden Fern's lettuce for something unique with a sweet, delicate flavor. Red Cardinal and Red Kitten spinaches have green leaves with red veins. Harvest throughout the fall for fresh-from-the-container garden flavor. Then add some cool season and edible flowers like pansies and calendula. They provide added color and flavor to fall meals. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Welcome back to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me for the rest of the hour is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and if you have a question or comment, we want to hear from you. Please, it's zestygarden@gmail.com for your email address. You can call us at 1-800-826-1495, or you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Don't forget to like us while you're there, and then just post a comment, and we'll be able to read that on the air as well. So during the break there, Diane, we were talking about wasps.
Yes.
And bees.
Yes.
So let's back up and talk about how they are divided, because I was thinking, you know, the wasps are separate from yellow jackets, but they're all actually part of the same family. But they definitely aren't bees.
So they're actually part of what we call the same order. So different levels of classification. You're familiar with, you know, the binomial system and how we have a genus and a species, Latin names that define an individual. But then they're grouped together by, you know, similarities. And so within the class insects, there are orders that are the different main types. So Hymenoptera is an order name, and that includes bees and wasps. So at that level, they're related under the group Hymenoptera. Characteristics are, many of them are social, but not all. A lot of them have very thin waists. They have ability to feed on nectar, pollen, other kinds of foods as well. And those kind of characteristics are what make them bees and wasps. And then below that level, then bees are often a different group. Bees tend to have a little hairier bodies, but there are exceptions, of course. And wasps tend to not have as much hair on their body. And so then there's many different kinds of wasps. So there's paper wasps, which include yellow jackets, the European paper wasp, our native paper wasp, and hornets. So all of those make a nest structure that where they use wood pulp or wood fibers to make their nest. So all of those are paper wasps. And then we have other kinds of wasps like mud daubers people are familiar with, where they use moist soil to build their nest. And many of these are social or have some level of social behavior. And those that are more social, such as the hornets and the yellow jackets that live together in a communal nest, they tend to be more aggressive because of that, because they're protecting their home together, and they tend to have a little more venom in their sting and sting more aggressively. And one thing about wasps is compared to honeybees, they don't have the barb on their stinger, and so they don't leave their stinger behind, where like with honeybees, when you get stung, your only redemption, I guess you can feel, is that
the bee died.
With wasps, that's not the case. And
one can sting you multiple times.
And they can sting you multiple times. So that can make them worse in that sense, too. The less social wasps, like what we call the European paper wasp and our native paper wasp, they do share some activities together. We'll have paper nests where there'll be several females that are taking care of young in that nest or laying eggs, but they're not as social as the yellow jackets and hornets. And so comparatively, they're not quite as aggressive. Their venom is not quite as painful. Not to say you get stung by a European paper wasp, it won't hurt, but it tends not to last as long or to be as painful.
How do they know to go for your eyes or your head or whatever?
Yeah, that's interesting. There has been some research to look at how, you know, stinging insects might perceive bodies, whether human or other kinds of animals, and they do tend to orient towards the head region. So something about the eyes and the openings, you know, ears, mouth, whatever, that tend to signal them that they know that's the most susceptible, you know, sensitive part of the animal. If they can sting there, they might deter them all the faster.
Do they have compound eyes?
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. They do. Yeah. They have quite good vision. And so that helps them in determining where they're going to sting. But oftentimes you get them trapped in your pants leg or something like that. And then, of course, that's where you get stung.
I'm remembering a time when I was younger, maybe 11 or 12, and I was by our hydrant. We had the store over in Mendon, so we had this hydrant outside that I'd have to take the mop, because I had to swab the floor on the inside and go out and clean out the mop and go back in and finish up. But that's where the yellow jackets would mm-hmm. come, because they're
drinking water,
mm-hmm. and I got one up my arm and three stings in a row before I finally took care of him. So it's hot. I mean, I still remember that all these many years later.
It'd be very painful.
And my poor wife this summer, she's been stung three times, once on an arm, most recently a couple days ago on her leg, and another one on her eye. So, and they're each, one was a bald-faced hornet, another one was a European paper wasp, and I think most recently were some yellow jackets.
Oh, so. She deserves to have a nice treat to help make up for that. But I have noticed, and we were talking about this, that this year, 2013, at least here in Cache Valley, I can't say that I can speak for the whole state, but we've really noticed a large population of yellow jackets this summer. They seem to be the most abundant of those paper wasps in terms of how many you see flying around, how many are now feeding on fruit. They like ripe fruit. They have to have a way to get into that fruit, but even just a ripe grape that cracks a little bit can be enough for them to get started. And you'll just see them kind of scooping out the whole, all the flesh of the grape. And so they are beneficial. We've talked before on the show how all of these wasps also are, they like to eat meat. And so they'll eat insects in your garden and other types of food sources like that as well. So they're not strictly fruit feeders, but they certainly this time of year can take advantage of that.
So right now, what's their food source? Are they looking more for sugar, or are they slicing off meat from your picnic?
The yellow jackets will do both. Generally, the European paper wasps this time of year, we've seen that they get more fruit fixated and they're really primarily feed on fruit. I think yellow jackets will do both, but because there is so much abundant fruit around right now, they're certainly taking advantage of that.
I have a large raspberry patch, and I usually see the paper wasps on that. So would the yellow jackets go into the raspberries?
They do need to have an opening provided to them, so they have to have some kind of a fracture in the skin. Certainly they can feed on raspberries. Generally, raspberries, as they get really ripe, they just kind of start to shrivel up. So I don't tend to think of yellow jackets as liking raspberries as much as they like grapes or peaches or even apple that's been pecked open by a bird or just had a crack in it as it gets very ripe. Like the galas tend to always crack up by the stem end. And then I'll see the yellow jackets really move into those.
I wonder where some years, and not so much this year, but other years, earwigs. Mm-hmm. I've seen them all over my raspberries. And so maybe that's getting the opening started. Then that's where they come along.
But in general, I've seen more European paper wasp on raspberries than I have yellow jackets in general.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left in the program. If you'd like to get in your question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can go to the UPR Facebook page and post your comment there, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So controlling these insects. Paper wasp populations seem to be depressed in my yard, so I'm not too much worried about them, although there's a great trap that mm-hmm. that would work really well, and so I told my wife, we're going to put this together. And you'll find the instructions for the trap on the Zesty Garden portion of UPR. But why don't you talk about the trap?
Yes, it's a little confusing because there's different kinds of traps, and they nest in different places. So Let's talk about the yellow jacket first, since we're focusing on that. You can buy a nice commercial trap. There are these little yellow canister type looking traps, and they come with a bait called heptobutyrate, most commonly. It's the most common bait that's very effective in drawing in. It's like it's a pheromone for the wasp, and so that works very well for the yellow jacket.
But it's only going to get the workers. It's
right.
not going to get
it's
the
not
queen
gonna
in
get
the nest.
The queen in the nest. No, so it's just going to get those that are out. And a lot of times, if you have hummingbird feeders out, things like that, where they're a problem. Or around your patio where you're trying to have a picnic, hanging one of those traps can at least help reduce some of the numbers and attract them over there. The European paper wasp is not attracted to that same heptobutyrate lure. And so what we found is the most effective is a homemade trap, and that's what you were referring to, where you use a pop bottle, convert it into a trap where you make a fruit juice, yeast, and water bait. And that one is attractive to the European paper wasp. And you can hang that around your fruit, production areas where you've got a raspberry trellis or something like that, but also around outbuildings where you know the European paper wasp are nesting. And they are those open cell, umbrella-shaped kinds of nests that hang from the eaves and roofs of or inside ceilings of outbuildings.
Well, these attract other wasps as well because like the mud daubers.
No,
those are really cool. I don't see a lot of those, and they're fun to watch.
I've never seen one of those in the European paper wasp nest.
Okay. So how much fruit juice to?
I believe it's 10 parts water. It's diluted to one part fruit juice and then like a quarter teaspoon of bread yeast.
And so just let it ferment for
a couple of days. So the first couple of days, it won't be too attractive. It has to get that fermentation process going. Also, you should add a couple drops of liquid dish soap just to break the surface tension so when they land on the bait, they'll fall in and drown.
And how often should that be changed?
Just basically watch and see how many you're catching. When it starts to get full or a lot in it, it'd be time to change it.
Okay.
If mold starts growing on it, that means maybe it's fermented a little too far, and then you should change it at that point.
Well, of course, maybe the wasps won't be able to fly back to the nest if they're a little bit drunk. So.
That's right.
What about the yellow jackets then? So I've got this hole in the ground. I see them coming in and out. I just stick the hose at night and pack around it so they can't, because they will fly out and go toward a light if I've got a light,
right,
and pack around it and then turn on the hose?
So water flooding can be used to destroy a yellow jacket. So you mentioned they nest in the ground most commonly. And so flooding can be used. Also there, you can purchase, wasp and yellow jacket insecticides, come in an aerosol can with usually like a little straw applicator. But do it at night when it's cool, and you can spray the insecticide down into the nest as well. I've had people say, what about pouring gasoline? We never recommend oil or gasoline into the ground.
I went online to YouTube and typed in yellow jacket control, and up popped these YouTube videos that it looks like they were taken in some backwoods country place, and they're pouring gasoline down. I'm like, I'm not even going to attempt to do that because the vapors follow you back and you could find yourself burned quite well.
Plus, you could be contaminating the groundwater, and that's not a good idea.
Well, Diane, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I've got one item from our gardening calendar I want to make mention of. USU Extension in Cedar City is featuring a class on fall vegetable gardening. It's Saturday, the 28th of September from 10 to noon at the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main. The course will include an overview of varieties that perform well this time of year and easy ways to protect them from the frost. All participants must register by calling 435-586-8132. Thank you for joining us on today's The Zesty Garden. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Thanks for listening to Utah Public Radio. It's 11 o'clock.